Good morning, everybody. Let me just reiterate the announcement that Sarah just made. This week, your lab is going to be not in your regular room, but in the computer lab, which we believe is room 124 Mulford. But Sarah is going to verify that and put it up as an announcement. So check the announcements if you're not sure where the computer lab is. It's on the first floor of Mulford. So be sure to go there. That's for the PVA lab, right? PVA lab, which is a fun lab where you actually get to put in practice what Professor Beisinger, our guest lecturer on Thursday, is going to be talking about. That's that stochastic population modeling that we discussed a little bit, just in contrast to deterministic population modeling two lectures ago. But today we're going to, normally the population viability lecture would be happening today, would be the nice segue from all the other stuff that we've been doing, but it didn't work out time-wise, so we're going to go move along forward to start thinking about community processes, away from strictly the small population focus, onto community processes, and then you're going to go back on Thursday, going to get the population viability lecture and the lab. So this is like almost like a digression, but not really a digression, because this is leading in to the next phase of stuff we're going to be talking about, building up to talking about how we select protected areas and reserve design, those kinds of things. So island biogeography theory has been really a kind of central conceptual model and theory within conservation biology, and so we're going to talk about that today. Islands have been important models for conservation. Okay. So why do you think they've been important models for conservation? What does that connote to you right there? What's our big problem? What's one of our major huge threats? I'm sorry? I still couldn't hear.
Rising sea levels.
Okay, rising sea levels. But that does something else. Rising sea levels does the thing that I'm talking about. Isolation, and what causes the isolation? It's the major threat to most species, habitat loss. And so this is not habitat loss, but this is a model for isolation. So this island is akin to a fragment of natural habitat that might occur. So we have an island of natural habitat on a continent as we get habitat loss. So that's why islands have been so important in conservation biology, as models in conservation biology. They've also been really important in evolutionary biology in general. Of course, Darwin came up with a theory of natural selection by studying island fauna in the Galapagos. That's what stimulated that idea for him. And so, you know, they're natural little laboratories of evolution, if you will. And so we have, again, isolation is the key factor here. Isolation leading to adaptive radiations to species differentiating from one another, to speciation processes. And so islands are a sort of a laboratory of evolution. That's why they're also important in conservation biology, same reason. What is island biogeography? Island biogeography is really the study of how species are distributed on islands, which includes those speciation processes. But island biogeography theory is something really, really specific within the study of island biogeography. So today, we're going to be talking about island biogeography theory. And this theory really was derived to explain three observations that had come about through the study of islands, in other words, through the study of island biogeography. And these three observations were, first of all, the species area effect that we've discussed already. We'll go over it again. Second, the isolation effect. And third, the species turnover and equilibrium species richness effect. And here we're talking about a temporal turnover, not a spatial turnover. Spatial turnover being our beta diversity concept that we talked about a while ago. Here we're going to talk about temporal turnover. So we're going to go over each of these empirical observations in some detail. And then I will describe to you island biogeography theory. So the first one is the species area effect. We've seen this slide before. There are lots of graphs like this that show the relationship between area and the number of species found on islands, in this case, Caribbean islands. And if you recall, oh, I forgot to get out my laser pointer. Excuse me one moment. Let me see if I can find it. Okay, so if you recall, if we look at the number of species against area, we get the saturating curve. If we take the log of species against the log of area, we turn this into a straight line. And that's just described here in these equations that we've seen before. The saturating curve, taking the logarithm of both sides and turning it into a straight line with the intercept here. This is, what is this? This z value, anybody remember? It's a constant, but tell me what it means. It means something. It means something about this line. Remember, this is the equation. It's the slope of the line, that's right. That's very important. And what does the slope of the line tell us? Anybody remember that? It's exactly, the slope of the line tells the rate of change of the number of species as we lose area, the number of species. Remember, this is not a population phenomenon we're talking about. Right now, it's a community phenomenon, or the number of species. Okay, so that's the area effect. And while I'm not going to show you tons and tons of graphs like this, there are tons and tons of graphs like this. This has been found over and over again in different sets of islands. So this was a big, you know, question mark. Why? Why do we always see this relationship? The distance effect, or the isolation effect, is that if you look at the number of species on islands in relation to some larger island or continent or mini continent, as you get further and further from that larger source, in this case, New Guinea, also an island, but a really big island and very species rich. As you get further and further from it, then the proportion of species found further away declines relative to that mainland. Let's call it a mainland. So in other words, it's like the number of species that you have on that mainland is your pool of species. And relative to that complete pool of species, as you get farther and farther away from that pool of species, less and less of them are represented on the farther islands. Does that make sense? Okay. So that's what we see here. This is degree of saturation is expressed as a percentage. So it's a percentage actually of an island of equivalent size that's near the mainland of New Guinea. So in other words, what that means is it's not just that these islands over here are smaller. If you look at these islands relative to an island of similar size but that's very close to New Guinea, then the percentage of the fauna that's found there is less. So here's the actual region that under question. Here's New Guinea, the large source island. So what a comparison would be something like some little teeny island here that's quite far away would be compared to a small island, a similar area, but that's very close to New Guinea, that doesn't have nearly as many barriers to colonization and would be nearly as species-rich as this, given its area. So the area effect is taken into account, but looking at the isolation effect, there's a lot fewer species further out. So that's what that means. And this is just the same graph shown before. Here's another way of thinking about the isolation effect. Again, we're in the same region, and this time looking at ants. And this time looking at islands contrasted against samples from the New Guinea region. So in this case, the sample plots have the same area as the islands. So let me just draw this on the board. I think it'll be more clear. So let's say this is New Guinea, and we set up a series of sampling plots of different sizes. And we contrast these plots and the species we find within them, for, in this case, ants, against islands that are perhaps all, hopefully all at a similar distance from this mainland. So, of course, the islands aren't really square, but that's easier to draw. So these are the same size. The A's are the same size, the B's are the same size, and the C's are the same size. So in other words, here we're looking at area being equivalent, but here we're taking samples from a larger region, whereas here these are true isolates. So that's the difference. So this would correspond to our samples from the larger region, and these are our true isolates. So what do you notice about those two lines? There's two things that you could notice about that are important. What's that? Are they similar? I mean, noticing about the slope is important. I agree with you on that. But that one looks like that, and that one looks like that. Is that a similar slope or different? Not totally. Well, that's true. I mean, one of them's not going like that. So that's true. I grant you that. They're both going in the same direction, but... Yeah, that's true. I have to think about what the implications of that might be. It's a good observation, not what I'm getting at, though.
I think the purpose is to compare it to the graph you showed earlier in lecture is that there's kind of an asymptote, and no matter how large the island is, it cannot continue the rate of that deviation.
Okay. So asymptote meaning at this end, or are you talking about...
I'm talking about the...
Okay, so lesser slope was what I was getting at. This is lesser slope. This is a lower slope than this one. This is a steeper rate of loss. Now, speciation is an important process on islands, but right now we're mostly talking about the number of species on islands, not their identities, and we're thinking more about colonization than about speciation. So that'll come up later. So slope's an important thing. And we said before that the slope tells us that as we lose area, in the case of this relationship here on isolated islands, we're losing species more rapidly than we are here. These aren't true isolates. These are just samples from within a larger habitat. Imagine that New Guinea is completely forested. Imagine that this is at a time when there hasn't been habitat destruction yet. So, now there's one other thing that's kind of, maybe it's too obvious to even think about. This lies above this. That's the other thing. So the two main observations that I want you to pull away from, and you've made some other good observations as well. This is more variable, for example. But the two main observations I want you to take away from this are the slope differences, shallow slope, and steep slope, shallow slope corresponding to when we're taking samples from a larger set. And this turns out to be something that's quite generalizable. On continents, the slopes of the species area curve are much gentler than in islands. So the species loss with area is more rapid in these true isolates than it is on these samples. The other thing is that this curve lies above this curve altogether. So what does that mean? What happens at any equivalent area? Yeah, at any equivalent area, you have more species on this larger, we're calling it continent for now. So that's important too. So this is an example of the isolation effect. The species pool here, this sort of source species pool, this is the sort of what we think of as the complete species pool. Not all of them make it out to these islands, because this is the source of colonists. Even if these go out, colonize, and then speciate, that could be happening. But what we're concerned about right now is just the numbers of species. So it's not, we're not really thinking about the speciation process per se. Whoa. Okay, so we talked about the area effect, those observations. We've talked about the isolation effect, that set of observations. And now we're going to talk about the temporal turnover. And this came about following a really spectacular volcanic eruption, again, in the same region of the world, Indonesia, Sumatra, those areas. In 1883, there was the eruption on an existing island called Krakatau Island. And this shows what the island looked like before the eruption. And after the eruption, this part of it was simply gone. This small Anak Krakatau came up later through subsequent eruptions. Lisa, you're smiling. Have you been there?
No.
Oh, okay.
Really dramatic.
Yes, it's dramatic. Anyway, so this means apparently child of Krakatau, because this came up later through subsequent eruptions. But anyway, this just got blown away. This entire island got sterilized by the explosion. In other words, all life basically gone. And this one did as well. And it was such a big explosion, apparently it was heard in Australia. So it was really quite amazing. That's just a Google, I don't know if you can see it very well, but a Google Earth image of it. Anyway, so here it is. Here's the region we're talking about in between Sumatra and Java. There it is. And so some years later, there had been some recolonization happening on these totally sterilized spaces. There were no plants. There was nothing. But so first the plants probably came in and other things. And then people started looking at bird species on these islands. And by 1908, there were some bird species on Rakata, the larger island here, the remainder of the volcano, 13 species. And then by 1919, there were 27 species of non-migrant birds, as well as some migrants. And then 10 years later, still 27 species. And on Sertung, the other island that had been sterilized, by 1908, only one non-migrant species. And then 1920s, 27 species, and 1930s, 29 species. Looking then not just at how many species, but who they were, they could infer who had gone extinct between the two census periods and who had colonized. Okay, they couldn't necessarily infer all of the extinctions and colonizations, because an extinction could have happened and then there could have been a recolonization event, but at least at a minimum, they knew who was no longer there and who had come in between the two sets of, between 1908 to 1919 and then between 1919 to 1932. And so what you can notice is that between 1908 to 1919, there were several extinctions that were observed. There might have been more, but those were the number observed. And a whole lot of colonizations. That makes sense. If you add up, if you subtract 2 from 13, you get 11. Plus 20, you get the total number there, 31. And then between, and similarly, on Sertung, no recorded extinctions and lots of colonizations, going from 1 to 29 species. And then in the next period, again, there were quite a few extinctions, 5 extinctions recorded and 4 colonizations, and 2 extinctions recorded and 7 colonizations. So a lot of flux going on. So here there's sort of 2 observations. I mean, this is a small data set, and I don't think that there are a lot of opportunities to study this kind of phenomenon, but what it suggested was that in a fairly rapid period of time, the number of species sort of stabilized. By 1920s, it was getting pretty stable on each island, same number of species. But the identity of species was constantly changing. There were these constant colonizations and extinctions. So kind of reaching this sort of stable number, but not always with the same individuals. So a very dynamic process of colonization extinction could be almost hidden by the fact that the number of species kind of stays the same. So that's what we mean by temporal turnover. And reaching an equilibrium species richness, this would be the equilibrium species richness that corresponds with our species area effect. Okay, so let's get back now to island biogeography theory. And really, the motivation for this theory, which was developed by two famous ecologists, Robert MacArthur and E.O. Wilson, who's the latter of whom is still alive, still pumping out great theories all the time. Anyway, they wanted to explain these three observations from island biogeography. They wanted to come up with a conceptual model and a mathematical model that would bring it all together. So this is what they came up with. So imagine that you start here. Well, first let me explain these axes. So this on the x-axis is meant to be a rate, either a rate of colonization or immigration, as it's often called, or a rate of extinction. And this on the x-axis is meant to be the number of species. They're listed, but they're just at the tops here. So this is meant to be the number of species. So the way you have to start thinking about this is imagine you start with an empty island like what would have happened after Krakatoa. Right here, there are no species on it. It's empty. And you have some species pool, some source from which species can arrive and colonize. And the idea is that the colonization rate curve is going to look like this. As more species come in, the rate of colonization will decline. And there are two reasons for that. First of all, as more species come in, there are fewer remaining species available to colonize. In other words, if species A has already colonized, species A can't really colonize de novo again. New immigrants could come in, new individuals could come in, but the species is already represented. So the source pool is a finite pool, and as more and more of its members get represented on the island, the rate of colonization by new species has to decline. So that's sort of the number one idea. And then the second idea is also that as more and more species come in here, there's more and more species, then there's fewer open niches as well. Less space and fewer ecological niches available for new colonists. So eventually, especially in a small island, a colonist might arrive and not be able to survive there because its niche is already filled, the space is already filled, it's occupied. So two reasons why the immigration rate would decline in a sort of curvilinear way. So let's talk about extinction now, what would be happening with extinction. And here they posited that the extinction rate would start to increase as the number of species on the island grew. And it's a similar kind of logic that as you have more species, as colonization has happened, there's more species available to go extinct, so your extinction rate will go up. If you don't have any species, you can't have an extinction rate. So that's one thing. And then also, as more individuals come in, as more niches get filled, as you get up here, there's more competition again, and so more likelihood that some species won't make it. So again, higher extinction rates. So you have this declining immigration rate and this increasing extinction rate, and they cross right here. What do you think this point might be? Any ideas? I heard equilibrium. Good. Equilibrium, E for equilibrium. Yeah, that would be your equilibrium number. And I think it does actually say it on the slide as well. Balance between colonization and extinction is where the two lines cross. And that would be your equilibrium. So let me try to show you this a little bit more graphically. What kind of a model is this? It's an equilibrium model. So the idea is, wait a sec, how do I do this? The idea is you're here. There's this number of species. E represents the number of species. You're right here. Your island is right here. And another species arrives. So then you've overshot. You overshot, and forces such as you overshot and your extinction rate goes up a little bit, that pushes you back towards the equilibrium. Maybe you get pushed too far. So you go this direction, or in other words, the island goes this direction, and there's too few species, and then a colonist arrives, and the extinction rate's lower, and it can survive. So that's what it means by equilibrium. With an overshoot, extinction rates should go up, colonization rates should go down. With an undershoot, extinction rates should decline a little bit, and colonization rates should go up. That's an equilibrium model, pushing the system to maintain the number of species more or less around this point. Okay, so this doesn't have anything temporal in it. This just, well, it does. It has rates, but we don't have time on this graph. So what if we had a graph that had time on it? And we have number of species here and time on it, and you're starting with an empty island. What do you think the graph should look like? So what I want you to do is just with a neighbor, I want you to talk this through and try to draw such a graph, what you think would happen, bearing in mind what we've been discussing. Okay, if anybody thinks they have it, if you wouldn't mind just going up to the board and just drawing it. I won't make you talk it through, but just anybody's got a candidate? Everyone keep talking so that no one's embarrassed. Just go on up. A few of you can do that. There's a question? Question? Okay. Several of you can do this if you want. Okay. Well, several don't need to because that's beautiful. Thank you. So... great. That's the idea, is that species would increase over time. It takes a while for this colonization process to happen. But your equilibrium notion is that you're going to bounce around that equilibrium for a while. It's not going to be totally rock solid stable. But once you get to that equilibrium, it should waver around that equilibrium. So that's great. Okay. So we talked about metapopulations a while ago. And do you guys remember metapopulations? Metapopulations are a population of populations. We've got some extinction phenomena going on. Some of these populations in their patches are going extinct, and then they may be recolonized. So we have another situation where we have an extinction-colonization dynamic with metapopulations, very similar to what we've been talking about with islands. But what's the difference then? What's the main difference between thinking about metapopulations and thinking about island biogeography? Any ideas? Yeah, Felix? Well, they have isolated, but you're right, it's at a different scale, probably. It's at a different scale, but they're still... it's perhaps a very... I'm asking a very obvious question.
I'm trying to be wrong,
You're not wrong. You're just like, maybe just partially there.
What would be the size of the area of the population?
Well, again, I think you're getting at a scale issue. Don't worry about it. You're doing good. You're trying. Oh, that's an interesting question. Are the islands a sink population? Well, they could be. They could be. But they could not be in the sense that perhaps a species would arrive there and would speciate, become actually a new species. So I'm actually getting at something really simple. Maybe it's too simple. That's what the problem is. Yeah, that's sort of what I was trying to get at, was just that Because sometimes, and I've noticed this also sometimes in the short answers, that people would start talking about populations and jump to species or vice versa. It's really important to keep these levels straight. You might have them straight in your head. In short answers on exams, be sure to keep them straight on your paper as well. That population phenomena do eventually verge into species phenomena, but with the island biogeography, we're talking about a community level phenomenon of the number of species, and with a metapopulation, we're at the population level. We're talking about the equilibrium number of patches that are occupied, as opposed to the equilibrium number of species that are occupying an island. They're highly related theories. In fact, mathematically, it can be shown they're the same theory. There's the same theory going on behind that. So both are equilibrium models. The metapopulation predicts equilibrium of the number of patches, whereas the island biogeography predicts the equilibrium of the number of species. So just try to remember to keep straight in your mind population phenomena versus species or community level phenomena. Interestingly, again, they're not predicting which patches are going to be occupied. In the case of metapopulations, they're not predicting which species are going to be the occupiers in the case of island biogeography theory. They're just predicting an equilibrium number of patches or number of species. So they're very, very similar models. Okay, so MacArthur and Wilson set out to explain all of the different observations that have been made for island biogeography theory. For island biogeography, the area effect, the isolation effect, and the turnover effect. We've talked about turnover, and this model can explain that, can predict that. But what about the area effect? So the area effect, basically, they posited that large islands and small islands would have different extinction and colonization curves. And so a large island should have an extinction curve that lies underneath the curve for a small island. Why do you think that would be? Why would a large island have a lower extinction rate curve than a small island? More resources, which could translate to okay, but think back to, I mean, you're on the right track, but I'm asking the whole class, think back to what we've been talking about with small populations, with populations.
Less susceptible to habitat loss.
What's the key variable that we've talked about with about population size? So populations are smaller, they're more susceptible to what?
Extinction.
So, and the resources are important. Resources and the habitat is a resource. All those things are important. More resources, larger population size, more buffered from all of these stochastic processes, genetic and demographic, that tend to cause population extinction. So with a larger island, larger habitat area, more resources, lower extinction rates because population sizes should be larger. That's the key idea there. Again, this is all a thought process here that's going on. It's a conceptual model. What about the immigration rate? They posited that the immigration rate or the colonization rate should be higher, should fall above that for small islands. And this is a little bit of an odd thought that they had. Just see if anybody has any ideas. Yeah. Exactly. That's it. That was their idea. Bigger area, bigger target for a colonist. So if the immigration curve falls above that on a large island, falls above that on a small, and the extinction curve falls below that of a large, then you have a new equilibrium. Again, our equilibrium is where these lines cross. So the two large lines are crossing here. The two small lines are crossing here. So our equilibrium number of species is bigger on a larger island. So this is how this conceptual model would go along with or explain the results seen, the species area results seen. Okay, so for this one, I'm going to let you work this one out. You've seen the kind of logic that is being utilized in island biogeography theory. Now let's do this for isolation. So again, with a partner, think about a near island versus a far island. You can play with either the colonization or the extinction rate or both. Think about which one makes the most sense. And add a curve or curves that show how immigration or extinction would compare on near versus far islands. And then see how that should affect the equilibrium number of species. Okay, so that's what you should do. And then somebody can just go up, or several of you can go up and draw it on the board again. This is just with one other partner. And as soon as you have, as soon as anybody has an answer they're comfortable with, just go ahead and draw it on the board. Does anybody feel daring, like drawing it up on the board? Maybe several of you can go do it. And if you could just label your near and far, that would be helpful. Yeah. Sorry, Lisa, can you just label your which is near and which is far on the colonization lines? Wait, is that right? Is that what you meant? I'm having a hard time understanding that. Oh, no, you're right, Sorry. I got mixed up. to get mixed up. Okay, so what MacArthur and Wilson thought was that on islands that were nearer, their colonization rate would lie above the colonization rate curve for the far islands, and thus that farther islands would have reduced species richness. And MacArthur and Wilson didn't really consider extinction. I mean, they considered it, but it was kind of subsumed within the colonization. They didn't really think that there was an independent extinction factor going on, that extinction rates would be higher on the far islands. But you could think of it as what, and they thought of it all in terms of colonization, because it's true that if you're on a far island and a species goes extinct, it's less likely to be recolonized. So the extinction is more likely to be long-lasting. But that's still playing with the colonization rate, not the extinction rate. So that's why they had it like this. I think in this one, this is similar, that the far colonization rate lies below the near. And then what do we have here? And the near extinction rate is lying underneath the far. Was that thinking about the rescue effect? Was that thinking about? Sorry, who drew this?
Oh,
okay, yeah. What was your thoughts about the? Right, the immigration would be higher, and so. But what was your thinking about the extinction rate being less? Was it more because it could be recolonized?
Yeah.
So which is fine. It's just that it is basically this folded in to the colonization. So, yeah, that, at least that's what was their thinking. Yes?
I thought about that, too. I thought maybe the extinction rate would drop because it could, the very closest island, the species could use resources from the mainland still, maybe?
That's a point, yeah.
Isolation.
Right, and I guess another point would be, they could use, perhaps because of if it was within their dispersal or foraging radius, they could use resources. And another point is that their population size might actually be larger. So MacArthur and Wilson didn't think about that. But I think actually this is valid, because so it's not just about the species recolonizing. It's that other individuals could help to shore up the population size. Having a migrant here or there would help to preserve genetic diversity. So indeed, the extinction rate could be lower. So we have these sort of two views on it. This is sort of what MacArthur and Wilson thought of, but I think this is perfectly valid as well. So, thank you. They didn't. They didn't have that in their model. Yeah. But again, it might also matter not just how far the island was from a source, but how far the island was from other islands that could also do the same sort of thing, where, again, you might have, then you see how the island thing becomes the metapopulation model. And they were thinking about the island model, but it really is almost, it is the same model. When you start thinking about individuals moving around that the population size, the population is then really a metapopulation on a set of islands. I don't know if that made sense or not, but hopefully that was not confusing but illuminating. Anyway. Okay, so this theory was put forward, and then E.O. Wilson, with one of his graduate students at the time, Dan Simberloff, decided to actually do an empirical test, an experimental test of the island biogeography model. And what they did was pretty drastic. They took advantage of the fact that you can get these very, very tiny islands forming by mangroves. It might just be a couple of mangrove trees that make a tiny mangrove island, for example, in the Florida Keys, which is where they did this. And what they did was they completely defaunated these mangrove islands. The mangrove islands have insects on them. So they were only looking at insect or invertebrate populations. So after defaunating them with insecticide, they watched what happened. They watched the colonization process over a period of 2 years. And here's the data. So they had four islands, and they're numbered here. And this was the initial number of species on those islands, of insect species on those islands, prior to the insecticide use. And so you can see, you know, here's the dark black curve going up like that, and reaching pretty after, you know, not that long, days after defaunation, within the 2 years, reaching pretty much the same level as it was before the defaunation occurred. And this is the E3 here, and then here's the ST2 coming out pretty similar, and then the E1. And there's another kind of interesting thing, is that usually they overshoot, and then they come back down. So that would fit with an equilibrium idea as well. They go a bit too far, and then they stabilize. There's also a lot of turnover happening. Yeah, so there was continuous turnover as far as the individual species that they were finding. This was changing all the time. So even after they reached the equilibrium, just constantly changing who's on there. Yeah, so basically, this experimental test really kind of confirmed the dynamic process of colonization, filling an empty island. Basically, the mangroves had become empty islands after the defaunation. And these sort of equilibrium phenomena of maintaining round about the same number of species that were there before. Yeah, I don't know.
I'm just kind of curious. I know you said there's like high turnover, but was the species composition after they were recolonized similar to like what it had been before?
I don't know. I don't remember. No, Sarah's nodding her head. No. Yeah. Right. I mean, I think the idea is that it's constantly changing. So it's constantly changing. So, yeah. So they would have, when they did the original sample, so when they got the baseline data, that's a snapshot in time. And that's probably changing, too. So, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I'm sure that there's a component of species that are quite consistent. Sort of the probably the most generalized species would probably show up on all of them. Okay, so that's island biogeography theory. Now let's talk for the rest of the period about how we apply it in conservation and specifically in reserve design. So we talked about this already, that typically when we're dealing with a sample on a continent, this line lies above an island or a true isolate or a fragment, something that is now becoming more and more of an isolate. So remember that when we're talking about a sample on a continent and we're thinking about a natural habitat, for example, we're talking about, let's say that we have a huge continent and there's a really large biome within this continent that's forest. So this is all forested. And our samples are taken inside this forest, and they're samples of different size. That's the line up on the top there. That's that line up there. But let's say we have another region of forest in here, and fragmentation is happening. So we're starting to get true isolates as we get habitat loss. So the idea is that as we go from a situation like this to a situation like this, these are no longer acting like samples on continents. These are starting to act more and more like islands. Perhaps not exactly like islands. We'll talk about that in a moment. But they're starting to act more like isolates. And so as that happens, We start off with a higher number of species because this curve lies above this one. That's what we talked about before. That's one of the important things to notice about samples on continents versus islands. This curve lies above this one, and the slope is more gradual. So as we get to a situation where we're going from samples on continents, the left side of my little drawing over there, to the right side of my drawing over there, to fragments, we might have a phenomenon that's called relaxation, the loss of species. And why might that happen? Well, in this situation over here, we have a contiguous habitat region. And so if, in this particular sample, a population does transiently go extinct, recolonization is pretty easy because there's other populations nearby. Whereas here, if a population goes extinct, recolonization may be harder. And so we're much more likely to lose species in this situation than this situation. So that's the main thing. And I can't remember if I already mentioned the rescue effect. The rescue effect, is that term refers to as a population goes extinct, there's a recolonization from a nearby patch. That's the rescue effect. It's just recolonization, but it's sometimes referred to as the rescue effect. So we get this relaxation to a new equilibrium. And this is actually something that we talked about before. Does anybody remember how we've seen this before and how we actually used it? Way back before the midterm? How did we use this? How did we use species area relationships? What kind of calculation did we make? Yeah, we looked at deforestation rates and how tropical deforestation would lead us to estimate extinction rates. And we did that based on species area relationships, looking at new areas, reduced areas. But the phenomenon behind this that we didn't discuss in as much detail as we are now is this relaxation phenomenon. So remember then we talked about the commitment to extinction? This process isn't instantaneous. It's more that as the area declines, that as the area declines, it's going to create a process of leading to a new equilibrium, a new lower equilibrium in the number of species. And so that's the commitment to extinction. Okay, but there might be a slight modification. Perhaps these isolates that I drew over there are not exactly like islands. They started off in a continental situation. They started off as part of a much larger region, and they became isolated over time, which is a bit different from an island. So people have thought maybe these things called land bridge islands make a better model. And what is a land bridge island? A land bridge island is an area that used to be, or at some point in its history, was connected to a continental region. And often this happens through sea level changes. So sea level rises, it becomes an island, sea level drops when there's a lot of glaciation, for example, and it becomes connected to the mainland. So this happens, I'll show you an example. And so people have looked at these land bridge islands, and this was also part of another observation within island biogeography, and they found, wow, when you look at a land bridge island, when you consider its history, when you consider that it has been connected at times to a mainland, these land bridge islands tend to have more species than we would expect based just on their area. So then the thought was that as the land bridge island becomes isolated, the land bridge island starts at one equilibrium and relaxes down to a new equilibrium. Because when it was a land bridge island, well, first of all, it has a bigger area because it's actually connected to the mainland, but it's also, and maybe it's connected through a small, what's that called, isthmus, I think that's the right word, connected by a relatively small sort of corridor. to the mainland, that corridor would permit some exchange, some species to go back and forth. It promotes colonization. So you're going to start off with this higher number of species in the first place than you would for an island of equivalent area. But as isolation of this region happens over time, as sea level rises, then you're going to relax back down. The colonization gets reduced, and the extinction phenomena start to kick in, and so you relax back down. That's very different than thinking about the empty island and over time moving up to a given equilibrium. So the idea is that because colonization was favorized in landbridge islands when they were attached, they're starting off at a higher point and relaxing down, as opposed to an island of volcanic origin, an empty island that's perhaps very distant from any source. So colonization is going to be less, and it's not going to reach the same levels of species numbers. So this might be a little bit more like the situation that happens on a continent as we get isolation, as we get fragmentation. Because formerly, just like in a landbridge island, these regions or samples within a larger biome were all connected. There was plenty of connectivity here, plenty of ability for colonization to rescue a population that went extinct. As you relax down to this, that starts to be constrained. There's less colonization, less opportunity for the rescue effect. But you started off in a situation that's more like a landbridge island to begin with. So that's sort of what people think might be going on with fragmentation. So here's an example of a landbridge island. Again, from the same region. This is the Sunda Shelf. So formerly, during the last glacial period, when sea levels would have been low, then all of this would have been connected. This would have been a huge peninsula. But then as sea levels rose, these became isolated regions. So what about some empirical tests? Do protected areas actually behave like landbridge islands as they become isolated? And there's been some work on this. It's been pretty controversial. Not everyone agrees with these results. But game reserves in Africa have been studied. And this is in Tanzania. There's a number of different reserves. Some of them are quite close to one another. But they're somewhat isolated from, especially this one. And this fellow, Bill Newmark, looked at the number of mammal species that had gone locally extinct. These were not global extinctions, but locally extinct within each of the protected areas, since they had become protected because they are isolated. And what he did was, it's actually sort of incredible that this would work, but he compared the observed number of species that were still persisting in these different parks, and he compared to an expected number of species that he thought should be persisting based on a model that was actually parameterized from data on landbridge islands in the Sunda Shelf. Totally different region, different biome, different situation. And he also did it with respect to another study that had been done on East African parks. But both of the studies, actually the points practically lie on top of each other, whether it was the Landbridge Island study or the East African Park study, and they got really good fit in both cases, which suggested that perhaps Landbridge Islands are good models. In other words, what he did was, based on the known time since these islands had become isolated, their areas and their isolation from one another, there was a model of how quickly species decline would happen. He applied that model to the data from Africa and to make the predictions. Given the amount of time since these regions have become isolated, how many species should be lost? And he got a really good fit. But it was highly critiqued because there's a sort of small amount of data that this rests upon, and that there's so many other factors going on. I mean, habitat loss is only one of many, many factors that affect species, particularly in this region in Africa. There's a lot of hunting going on, poaching. There's other things that are happening. So that's why this was critiqued, but it's still kind of interesting. So I think I might skip this question. The island biogeography theory is a very conceptual model. It has sort of a minimal amount of biology in it. You know, the notion that there's a larger area island is going to be a bigger target for species, and that's why colonization rates would be greater, and that population sizes, as population sizes are, again, larger area, population sizes larger, and so less extinction rates, those kinds of things. But it's pretty minimal. There's not much biology in there. I was going to ask you to do this, but I don't think we'll have time to do something that I think is more interesting. So we can think about biological reasons for the species-area relationship. And one of them we've already talked about in a fair amount of detail, and this is an important one: reduced resources, reduced population size, higher extinction probability. That's really sort of what was behind their thinking. But there's other things too, like, you know, if the species just has a home range that's actually bigger than the isolated area, then obviously it's not going to live there. It's not going to persist. Edge effects, we talked about this a little bit. We'll talk about it again in the future. The actual area available for a species is smaller than the measured area. They might not deal that well with the ocean-land interface, for example. Loss of habitat diversity. As you get a smaller region, you're probably having less habitat diversity. We saw this with the Euphydrius checkerspot butterfly example. They need habitat diversity to survive. They need warm slopes and cool slopes to deal with different weather patterns. So loss of species needing multiple habitats, that would be an example. Loss of specialists for a given habitat. And then simplification of ecosystems and loss of mutualists. Often island ecosystems are very, very simplified compared to continental ones. A lot fewer species. And then as you have fewer species, then you have fewer mutualists that can that depend on them. Okay, so this is what I wanted to get to. I wanted to leave a little bit of time for this. So this whole island biogeography thing, it really created this huge furor in the early days of conservation biology. And the big debate was, should we be protecting one large area because that's where we're going to get more species? Or should we have lots of small areas? And in general, this is a real problem. We have a fixed budget, often for conservation, or a fixed land area that we're allowed to protect. How do we protect it? Do we protect one big, huge area, or do we protect a lot of small areas? So here, I would like you to form your groups and pretend that you're on the board of the Nature Conservancy. You have a set amount of dollars to purchase set-asides for conservation. You could either purchase one large forested area or a number of smaller separated parcels totaling the same area. And I want you to weigh the trade-offs, the pros and cons. You've got some different goals for protection. On the one hand, the jaguar is a species with a large home range, is known to occur here, and is a target species for conservation. On the other hand, it's a region of Central America known for its rapid ecological transitions along steep environmental gradients. So explore the pros and cons of single large versus several small reserves. That's your task. And if we have time, I think probably we'll have time. You can write them up. So we'll put up some pieces of paper. And then hopefully we'll have time to actually go over it as well. Okay. You need a pen? Yeah, those are good. This one just kind of exploded, but it still works. See, this one still works after I broke it. Looks like it does. Oh, the pens?
No, the chalk.
Oh, wait, sorry. I forgot to get my chalk out this day. Oh, that's fine. Yeah, you can use that. Okay, everybody, since we're beginning to be at the end of the period, I'd like you all to turn your attention to the boards and be reading what your classmates came up with, because there's a lot of good ideas up here. And I'm not going to have time to read them all out. So I want you to go ahead and be reading them, thinking about their commonality, you know, what's in common to these different answers. Maybe you'll notice one up there that your group didn't have. That's something smart. And I see we've got one that's actually a real conservation plan developing on the board. That's great. Okay, so I think you probably noticed perhaps a tension in your group. Hopefully there was a tension in your group between thinking about, you know, how do we protect this, you know, one species that requires a lot of territory. And also protect all this diversity that's out there. This is a tension that continues to plague conservation biology today. And I think that I'm seeing this tension reflected up in what you've written here, that this one big habitat is going to promote the persistence of the jaguar and probably of other species as well. We really want that. Persistence is our goal. But at the same time, if we've just missed out a huge amount of the diversity to begin with, that's going to be a problem. We're losing maybe these small, narrow endemics right from the start because they just weren't even included in our reserve. That's going to be a problem. So I think Tiana is trying to incorporate both so that, you know, you could have your jaguar species in a large home range, you know, a large range for it, but also try to incorporate those elevational gradients, et cetera. Well, that might work if the jaguar likes the elevational gradients. It might not if they don't. So that's basically the tension. I think I included this slide in your handout. I can't quite remember. Do you guys have this slide? Okay, so then this is my summary of it. But, you know, there's no easy answers. Most of the factors leading towards thoughts about persistence have to do with large. We want large to have persistence of populations. But as far as representing all the biodiversity that's out there, it's really going to depend a lot on how the species are distributed, on the pattern of beta diversity, that concept we explored in the early part of the course. If spatial turnover of species now is high, then a lot of small reserves might better represent that that pattern of diversity. And so that's important. Another one I think I didn't see up here is that if you've got a lot of small reserves, you might spread your risk a little bit. There, if there's a catastrophe and it wipes out one of them, it might not wipe out all of them. So there's some notion of risk spreading by having more smaller reserves. But in general, it's contentious. It's difficult. We probably want both. We want a large area, and we also want to represent all that biodiversity. We might not always be able to get at it. So I'll leave you with one parting thought that, not necessarily what all conservation biologists think, but it's important to have lots of reserves. It's important to keep them close together. It's important to have some that are large, at least. And it's really important to think about what the matrix is around those reserves, that ensuring that there's connectivity between them, possibly by having friendly land uses around them, is going to be really important as well. So I'll leave you with that parting thought, and we'll see you here next Thursday.